President Reagan took the oath of office in the White House just a week ago. And then on Monday, he went to the rotunda of the Capitol to celebrate a rather cut-down inaugural ceremony. The cold was as omnipresent there as it is, as was here. In the course of his inaugural address, the president referred to himself as an older American. And at 73, he is, of course, the oldest person to take the oath of office as a president of the United States. Recalling, as I'm sure most of us do, the unfortunate consequences of President Wilson's fatal illness during the last years, months of his second term, and the consequences both for international and domestic affairs, we can only hope that the president will enjoy the fullness of health during the 4 years of his term and take some comfort from the fact that when Moses was finally summoned to his death, and I make no comparison between Moses and Ronald Reagan, he was 120 years of age. And the Bible says, Lo kachata eino velo neis lecho, that his eyes were not dimmed and his vigor had not diminished. In that address, the president spoke with the words of optimism and buoyancy which have marked his political career from the very beginning. He has a youthful spirit, and he has retained that spirit throughout the years. And it is a spirit, I think, which in the last analysis has served this country well. Because I'm convinced that whatever else history says when it finally passes judgment on Mr. Reagan's political career, it will say that he found ways to lift the American spirit. It's part of the conventional wisdom that as you age, your sense of optimism about the future diminishes. The Bible also tends to repeat this conventional wisdom. The young men have visions, but old men simply dream dreams. The more experienced we are, the more we recognize how few of our youthful expectations come to fruition, how full of contradictions human nature really is. And so there's a natural tendency to allow one's vision to become more narrower and more circumscribed the longer one lives. And it's to the president's credit. It's to the credit of, I think, his native spirit, his natural spirit, that the years have not dimmed his optimism, and that he has found ways to communicate that zest for the future, that sense of promise, to the American people. If one were to take as a theme from his inaugural address a single phrase, it might be this sentence: Let us stand as one today, one people under God, determined that our future should be equal to our past. Remembering, of course, that in the context of Mr. Reagan's sense of history, the past of America is one of prosperity and of meaning and of mission. Mr. Reagan came to office. He was elected, I think, in large part because of this gospel. And I would remind you that the etymology of gospel is from two Latin words, which means a good tale. He told Americans good things about themselves, and most importantly, about the future. He came on this scene at a time when we were rather despondent. We'd gone through 15 years of the agony of Vietnam. There had been the sickening discoveries of Watergate. Americans were increasingly living in and around the major megalopolitan areas and having to endure all of the confusions and of the erratic violence of the city. Life was anything but simple. You recall that his inauguration to his first term took place just at that point in time, when the year-long agony of watching so-called Iranian students imprison Americans was coming to an end. Americans were unsure of their power, unsure in their role in the world, unsure of the economy. Inflation was rampant. There were changes taking place in the marketplace that no one really fully understood. And as we went from the more primitive iron and steel economy to that of the computers, and modern technology, high tech. The president stood forth at that time, and he did so again last Monday as an apostle who preached a gospel of good tidings. The future can be equal to the past. There's no reason to see only the shadows. And it was not only the political events that gave Americans a foreshortened sense of the future, made them feel that there were only shadows and darkness ahead. About 25 years ago, the social activist, an academic, Michael Harrington, described what he called the other America. The other America consisted of that 10 or 15% of the American people who, because of poverty or because of race or because of social or educational or cultural deprivation, were not able or had not been able to take part, to participate in American opportunity. And it's to the credit of the American spirit that, to a very large degree over the last 30 years or so, we have been concerned with the other America. It's concerned to a degree that we've often come to see the other America as the only America, to see the problems and not the prosperity, to see the challenges that we had to face and not the successes that we already enjoyed. And Ronald Reagan came along with a gospel which had very little place, unfortunately, for the other America. But he spoke of the unother America, the original America, the 80% or so who are earning a good living, who are able to provide for their families, who are able to educate their children and to provide them with opportunity, the largest group within the society who, since the days of the Great Depression, had seen opportunity and prosperity increase from decade to decade. Now, the importance of optimism, of buoyancy in the national spirit, is a very simple one. Some Americans tend to put down Mr. Reagan simply as a cheerleader. But I'd like to suggest that his role has been far more important. For in life, you can only become what you think you can become. And if you're determined that you can't achieve, you won't even try. If you're not willing to climb the mountain, you'll never climb the mountain. And so a nation which has a sense that it will never fulfill its national purpose will not fulfill whatever that purpose, whatever it may be. And a nation whose people are increasingly unwilling to look at the future with any sense of confidence is a nation where the individuals tend to pull in on themselves, to turn in on their small, individual, narrow programs, to try and build up bunkers against the larger society. It's a society which tends to dissolve, to fall in on itself, to implode. A society which has very little future because it has no confidence in that future. Ronald Reagan is the president of the unother America, of the majority of Americans, and his popularity is attested both by the polls and by the last elections, prove that he has found a resonant chord, a responsive chord, in the spirit of that larger America. But on the other hand, as he spoke that inaugural day, it was clear that during the last 4 years, because of his spirit, because of his point of view, his point of outlook, very little attention had been paid to the other America, to the needs of the poor, to the problems of race, to the destitute and the homeless. I went to find the actual text of the president's inaugural address, because of course one could not find it in our local newspaper. The Cleveland Plain Dealer told us about the cold, it told us about what Mrs. Reagan wore, it told us about what local bands were not able to march down the road, but it did not give us but a line or two of the text of a major address, which apparently this president wrote out himself, or to a large degree wrote himself, a text which would give us some significant indication of his concerns, of his programs, of where he was going to try and lead us during the next 4 years. I found that text, of course, in the New York Times. And in it, he speaks of the society of opportunity for all. He speaks of the need for caring for the sick and providing for the homeless. But at the same time, of course, I found myself saying, whenever I came to a sentence such as that, the old rabbinic phrase, you know, would that his ears heard that which his mouth was speaking. Because there's been very little indication, as you know, of concern for meeting the social and the welfare problems and the racial problems of our society in this administration. At the same time, it was interesting that there appeared in that Tuesday morning issue of the New York Times a piece by Sidney Shanberg, he and now of Killing Ground fame, which he called The Poverty Divide. The president made a great point of the fact that during the last 4 years, inflation has been brought under control. There have been 25 straight quarters of economic prosperity. There is a sense of well-being in the land. The levels of unemployment have receded by 4 or more percentage points. But in that column on the op-ed page of Tuesday's New York Times, and I don't know if it was planned by the Times this way or was simply a matter of chance, Sidney Shanberg began his piece by saying, New York is booming economically, period. Second sentence, more people are hungry and homeless in the city than at any other time since the Great Depression. And further on, there was this sentence, Manhattan glitters, and the homeless sleep in the doorways. There is that sense in Manhattan, there's that sense in Cleveland, in most of the cities of the United States, of a growing separation, divide, between the haves and the have-nots. And there has been precious little indication on the part of this administration that they have any real program to prevent our society from becoming what we hoped, all of us hoped it would never be, a class-bound society, a society which was divided as most European societies were divided, by privilege and lack of privilege, by affluence and lack of affluence, by power and lack of power, classes which inevitably must conflict, compete, fight with each other, and ultimately prevent the creation of true community. Now, this administration has, over the last 4 years, insisted that insofar as the society itself becomes more prosperous, everyone will benefit. And it seems to be mesmerized by an idea which it calls social dependence, and that is that somehow the economic and welfare programs of the last 30 and 40 years have bred into the society, or into large parts of the society, a need to be a tendency to prefer dependence to work, to prefer the dole to one's own employment. And so the policy of this administration seems to have been to find ways to increase prosperity, and to a very large degree they have encouraged the larger prosperity, and also to allow the shoe to keep pinching, so that those on whom the shoe pinches will find good reason to get out and to work and to join in the economy of labor into the sense of participation in the society as a whole. Now, one of the truths which faces Mr. Reagan, which faces all of us, and it is not a fact for which he and his administration are primarily or uniquely guilty, is the fact that beginning in the middle 1970s, for the first time in 40 years, that percentage of Americans who were in the other America began to increase. It's Since the middle 1930s, year after year, we have found ways to decrease the number of those who live below the poverty line. And then in the early 1970s, that percentage began to flatten out. And beginning around 1976 or 1977, it began to rise again slightly, but to be on the rise, and has been on a slight rise ever since. And this, of course, must be of concern to all of us. The reasons that some in Mr. Reagan's administration give for this rise has to do with this so-called sociology of dependence, that it's easier to remain on the dole than it is to go out and earn a living, that there's so little difference between what one can receive on welfare and what one earns from a job which pays a minimum wage, that it is far better to not take the job, and that there's no social cachet, no social cost to one in being on public welfare. Now, there may be some truth to this. There are welfare cheats, just as there are Social Security cheats and people of great wealth who cheat on their income taxes. There is dishonesty in all levels of society. But the larger truth, of course, is that those who are handicapped, those who have been denied or been unable to be provided with a decent education, those who lack the skills to come into the society as a whole and participate fully in it, are handicapped, are unable, whatever be their desires, to participate in a society which is going through some major systemic changes. Part of the reason of the sudden reversal of what was this gradual diminution of the other America has to do with a changing economy, which we've all sensed. We sense it particularly in a city like our own, a city based on iron and steel and basic industry and in the mass production line. The number of factory jobs has decreased in actual numbers over the last 4 or 5 years. It was static for a number of years before that. And these traditional factory jobs provided decent income for large numbers of people who had minimal educational skills, but who could perform some kind of simple repetitive task, and who could, through their union and labor negotiations, gain decent wages for performing those tasks. But now we were in an age of high tech. A different kind of worker was required by the society. A more sophisticated kind of education was required of the worker. An ability to move from job to job and to bring to the job certain kinds of not only informational but technical skills. And we had a group of people who were untrained, who were passing through the society, who could not make the adjustment to this changed economic order. And then, of course, there are radical changes in the birth rate. This is one of the things that sociologists and columnists rarely speak about, but it's a fact, the hidden changes in the society. The birth rate of middle-class America and upper-middle-class America fell in the 1960s for the first time below the replenishment rate, 1.8, 1.7, 1.9 children per family. The birth rate of those who live in the slums of the center city remained fairly high. There were more children coming, therefore, into families which could not provide for them the support systems which allow a child to go through the turbulence of childhood and adolescence and to remain within the educational system to retain some degree of purpose. Numbers who were coming through grew proportionately faster than the numbers of those who could be provided for in homes such as those represented here. And so the dropout rate from high schools increased markedly over the last 10 years. And the cost of living in the slums of the center city increased also. There were more and more families in which there was no man, no father present. There were more and more homes which were broken up without any sense of cohesion provided by either partner. And all of these factors during the last decade or so have led to the statistics, which are so shocking and so frightening in terms of their long-range consequence. What does it mean for a society which can no longer provide greater and greater opportunity to more and more, or even opportunity to more and more? And this, of course, is the challenge which faces this administration, which would face any administration. One cannot argue with the president's conclusions that the well-being of the society, of the economy as a whole, ultimately is important to everyone, and that whatever steps need to be taken to see to the strengthening of that economy ought to be taken. But at the same time, it requires a simple statement of moral concern, of righteousness, of concern with righteousness, to recognize that one cannot simply abandon, throw one's hands up, be indifferent to the other America, and cut its safety net, cut its support systems, whatever judgment one may feel is necessary to pass on its attitudes towards taking advantage of that system. The president, in this address on Monday, spoke of hope of the future. And I think most Americans want to sense that there is some hope for our future. And our own reactions to the sense of the mounting deficit suggests that concern. For it is not so much we who will face the cost of that deficit, but our children and our children's children, because the interest rates are then built in year after year into the cost, the social cost of government. There was no more hypocritical statement in that inaugural address than that rather theatrical statement that we ought to pass a constitutional amendment which mandated and guaranteed that the Congress would not enact a budget which was anything but balanced. Hypocritical because this is the president who, in his first 4 years, has overseen deficits which exceed in cost the total deficits which were accrued under all other administrations in our American history. Besides being a foolish idea, it's always a foolish idea to straitjacket government planners. It was the one in which only purpose can be to try and signal to the American people that under our Constitution, ultimately the power of the purse lies with the Congress, and that somehow he and his administration are innocent of the unbalanced budgets which have been seen over the last few years and obviously will continue to be seen over the next years. We're facing a budget of deficit of over 200 of billions of dollars. And it is not simply the fault of the Congress that these budget deficits are passed. The Congress must vote the appropriations. They do so on the advice of and under the prodding of and under the demands of the administration. The administration has powerful weapons at its hands to ensure that most of its programs are passed. We need, obviously, to face these deficits, to bring them down, to bring them under some kind of control. And surely most of us feel that those controls, those cuts can come not simply out of the services which go to the other America or the elderly America, but must come out of some of those costs which are now going into middle-class America, the programs such as Social Security, and costs which go into the defense, the military budget, which has become so large, so bloated in the last few years. Now, the president is not an evil man. The president is a man who has a particular vision. And his vision, interestingly, includes the possibility of programs which may, in fact, radically change the nature of the American society and make it a more just and open society. It's a paradox, and I don't pretend to be able to resolve it for you. But the program of tax revision, which was proposed by his own Treasury Department several months ago, is a program which can only be hailed as a vast improvement on the tax system which is now in place, and a program which will benefit not the wealthy, but the poor, not the wealthy, but all of us. I'm not quite sure how it came to be that Mr. Reagan's Treasury Department brought forth a proposal of this kind, but whatever be the reasons, it is probably the most hopeful domestic sign on the horizon, and one which, if enacted in its major components, would, I think, revive in America a sense of equity, of justice, which has been missing for a long, long time. For if truth be told, it is not only the other America which has felt increasingly alienated from its own government, but many in middle America, many who saw themselves paying substantial taxes and recognized that the government had to pass a so-called minimum tax law to see that some of the very wealthy paid any tax at all, because there were so many ways in which one could evade taxes. And where we saw giant corporations who not only were excused from taxation, but who could sell tax relief packages that they technically, by various technical manipulations, claimed that they were owed by the government, sell them to other corporations, so those corporations would not have to pay their taxes. According to this system, there would be a three-tier uniform system of taxation for corporations and for individuals. And most importantly, according to this new proposal, any family earning less than $13,000 a year, which is somewhat above the poverty level, would be excused from paying any federal taxes at all. The poor would have more money. And one of the unfortunate consequences of the last few years is that the statistics show that whereas some of us in the middle class have received tax relief, those in the lower classes economically have received not only no tax relief, but proportionally their taxes have slightly increased. They would be free, those who earn $13,000 or more, from further taxation. And then there would be uniform rates without exemptions, without tax shelters, without deductions, except for one's home's mortgage, for all the money that you earn beyond that. One of the sad things, I think, which we've all recognized in our society is that the level of evasion, the number of people who are prepared to evade their taxes, has grown. And why has it grown? For the obvious reason that no one likes to be an innocent, and that one recognizes that the person next door who earns what we earn may be paying half the taxes or much less or much more than, in fact, we do. The present system is not equitable. And the interesting thing about this proposal is that I think it would provide the President of the United States with a way to go down in history as one of the truly great presidents of the United States. Everyone in Washington is convinced that this tax proposal has absolutely no chance to pass. And what they simply mean is that there are so many individual advantages built into the present inequitable system. So many industries, so many labor unions, so many charities, so many groups tend to benefit from the present system, that all of their pressure exerted through effective lobbyists will be exerted to see that it does not pass. And there are all kinds of IOUs out there between the PACs and the contributions which have been given to our legislators and these groups. And these groups represent not only what we tend to call special interest groups, special privileged groups. They represent major groups in the society. Universities, fearful that people will no longer donate to their endowment funds. The United Appeal, fearful that the level of contributions to the various social agencies of the city will diminish markedly. Nevertheless, it seems clear to me that if the president were to take this proposal seriously and to make it his own and take it beyond the District of Columbia, beyond all those intricate relationships between lobbyists and Congress and pressure groups in Congress which exist within the district, take it to the people, he would find among us a responsive court. And ultimately, our legislators, of course, respond in turn to our own interests. America needs a major change in its whole domestic way of operation. We need all of us to feel a new sense of closeness to government, of closeness to the national purpose. And it is in the taxation system that the greatest sense of distance, of frustration, of bitterness, and of anger is built up. Here is a system which would benefit the poor, which would equalize the burden on all Americans. It's not a perfect system. No system of taxation is. But it would be a magnificent step forward and one for which this president, I think, would be blessed by the country, and one through which he would change in a very marked way the attitudes of people towards government. And if the president, in fact, has this sense of optimism about the future, I hope and pray that he will take this proposal seriously, truly make it his own, and turn it into a great crusade. They say that a president during his second term of office is interested in not only in the well-being of the society, but knowing how his name and years of power will go down in history. And some have been saying that the president is interested now in arms control negotiations because that is the way he will make his name in history. I would suggest to you that no president will make a name for himself that is historic in consequence through arms control negotiations. Because arms control negotiations are, by definition, complex. And when they are between bitter enemies, great global powers competing for global influence, whatever is finally written down will be so complex, so filled with loopholes, that very little really, truly will be accomplished. We often refer to SALT I and to SALT II, the strategic arm limitation treaties that are in place. At the end of both treaty periods, there were more missiles at the ready than there had been at the beginning of those periods when those negotiations had in fact been completed. It's very likely that whatever arms negotiations were undertaken would end with the same unfortunate result. If we want peace, we must find ways of diffusing the competitive greed, the competitive ideologies, which put nations at loggerhead. As long as those ideologies remain powerful, as long as the greed, the urgency to take to oneself what is not your own, remain the dominant themes of the jungle, which is international affairs, arms negotiations can have at best the virtue of at least having the countries talking with one another, open to one another, gaining time. But no president will make a name for himself through arms negotiations. But in domestic terms, this president, at least I think, has the opportunity to transform the economic base of the society, the nature of the relationship between the citizens and each other and the citizens of their government for the good, the kind of opportunity which comes very rarely to any man or any president in any lifetime. And so a new administration begins. Whatever we think of Mr. Reagan, he is our president. We wish him well, and we wish him health, and we hope and pray that that which needs to be done to strengthen the society, to strengthen the economy, to strengthen the relationship of the community with itself will be done, and that the dream which is Mr. Reagan's will in fact come true, that our future may be as blessed as our past. Amen.